This is a somewhat unusual experience for me this evening, at least these days, in that I, after spending many years in Ubon, majority of them at Wat Bananachat, and doing a fair amount of teaching, mostly the monastic community, in English. The last few years I've been living a more solitary existence, and almost all of the teaching that I do these days is in Thai, so it's very rare for me to have the opportunity of speaking about the Dhamma in English. And particularly this evening, and there are to me a few familiar faces, but most of you I don't know, so I'm not really sure exactly what you'd be interested in listening about, and how much background you have in Dhamma. Maybe that many of you know more about it than I do, but anyway, I'll give a few thoughts and reflections, and then if it's not really on the things that you'd like to listen to, or you have any particular interests or questions, then we can have a period of discussion afterwards. I would like to start off with just giving you like an overall picture of Buddhism, Buddha Sasana, making a comparison with the religions that grew up in the Middle East. And I like to look on religious traditions as so you can form into two major families, and the family of religions that grew up in the Middle East and the family of religions that grew up in India. I think that we can characterize the family of religions that grew up in the Middle East, posing of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, as basically belief systems. And indeed, these religions are often referred to as the great faiths, which tells us straight away that faith is considered to be the major or defining virtue of those religions. So we can say that these are religions as belief systems characterized by the centrality of faith. Now that is such a dominant understanding of religion in the Western world that there's often quite a lot of confusion about Buddhism, and there's an attempt to define it in terms of belief system. So Buddhists are often asked by friends who profess other religions, "Oh, you're a Buddhist, what do you believe in?" Assuming that Buddhism is more or less the same kind of thing. It's just that Buddhists believe in a different set of things than the people who believe in Christianity and Islam and so on. And as you're probably aware, there's been these long debates: is Buddhism really a religion at all, or is it a philosophy, or is it a way of life, and all these kinds of endless, slightly pointless debates that have been going on for so long. Now, I would like to propose the idea that Buddhism is not a belief system, it's an education system. So it's a whole different kind of religion So we're not talking about religion as belief system, but belief, but religion as an education system, or in the traditional formulation, a training. Here we're training education used more or less interchangeably. So the Buddhist education is an education which is carried on in four main areas. This is the area of our relationship to the physical world, our relationship to the social world which we live in. These are the two external spheres of this education. And then there's the education of the heart, of emotions, thoughts, the elimination of vices, the development of virtues, and then fourthly and supremely, the development of wisdom. So there are two external spheres of education and two internal spheres. And the external, the first external sphere of education, that concerning our relationship to the physical world, begins with that aspect of physical world most intimate to us, our own bodies. And so developing an intelligent relationship to physical body, starting off with things like nutrition, how you eat, how you how much you rest, how much you exercise, all these things are considered to be part of Buddhist tradition, in the sense that if you don't have a sensitive, intelligent relationship to your physical body, then it's highly unlikely that you'll develop more spiritual qualities. So there is this close interrelationship between the external and the internal. From there, going on to relationship to all those things that you consider to be yours, your wealth, your possessions, and so on, developing an ability to relate to these things in a way which is not conducive to suffering. This external sphere carries on onto the relationship to the physical environment. So everything in the material side, from starting off from our bodies, going on to the nature in which we live. The second external sphere, that of the social sphere, the role of sila, morality. So in Buddhism, we don't have this idea of a supreme being who rewards or punishes. But there is an idea that there are certain ways of living together are conducive to misery and suffering, and certain ways of living together are conducive to happiness and joy, and that human beings are capable of determining those ways of living together which are conducive to happiness and joy, and inclining towards them and to developing communities based upon them, that we do have that intelligence and ability within us. And the sila, morality, means that we ask ourselves, what would we consider to be an ideal community, an ideal family situation, an ideal work situation? How would we live together in a way which we would consider most satisfactory? If we could create our dream community, what would it be like? And I think that most of us would say, well, it'd be a community in which people didn't abuse each other, didn't hurt each other, in which you felt safe, that you didn't have to be afraid that someone was going to come up behind you and stab you or hit you over the head, or you didn't have to worry all the time that someone was going to steal your things, that you could just put your things down and be quite sure when you came back they were exactly where you left them, in which you didn't have to worry that someone was trying to entice your partner away from you, or in which there wasn't this constant sense of mistrust and suspicion amongst spouses, and in which you could trust what people said to you, that you didn't have to doubt, is it really the truth? Are they trying to get some kind of advantage out of me? Well, you didn't have to go through all that kind of doubt and suspicion. Well, you know, if somebody said something, that's what they meant. And a community in which people were committed to sobriety and to development of clarity of mind, mindfulness, clear comprehension, to the extent that they were not interested in taking drink or drugs and things which undermined those higher faculties of mind. So if we could accept that as a basic premise, then next step is, well, how could we bring that ideal situation into being, or at least, you know, what steps could we take towards that which would be practical, you know, realistic? And so the Buddhist answer is the same. You use the power of intention, the intention to refrain from killing, hurting, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, indulgence in drink and drugs and so on. And that's something that is practical and realistic, isn't it? As far as action and speech is concerned, we can exercise a governing influence over these things through intention. Now, you cannot decide not to get angry with someone, but you can decide not to shout at them or to hit them. So this is a recognition of a resource that we all have, the ability just to say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to hit, I'm not going to hurt, I'm not going to steal, and so on. Now, when we take on a precept, through seeing the value of it, and through seeing the suffering and the unpleasant consequences of not adhering to that precept, then it becomes a peg for mindfulness. So the more clear you are, the more committed you are to a precept, the more it is, as it were, in the front of your mind, then the more likely it is to pop up in your mind when the desire to act in a way which transgresses that precept arises in your mind. Let's say a mosquito bites you, and then you have the conditioned desire just to swat the mosquito. Now, if you've taken on a precept, then something interesting happens. As you're about to swat the mosquito, the thought arises in your mind, oh, I can't do that, it's against my precept. Now, that's very interesting, because you've now driven a wedge in between an intention and its expression through a moment of mindfulness. That moment of mindfulness has arisen through the recollection of the precept, of the commitment to the precept, the intention not to. So you remember that you've decided not to do that in such a way that it pops up in your mind when you're about to commit that action. And driving a wedge between intention and action gives you a certain kind of freedom that you've not had before. You have the freedom, do I really want to do this or not? So this is a moment of awakening on the level of sila. It gives you more choice, it gives you more awareness, it gives you more freedom. So it is quite sobering to observe to what extent we are conditioned by input through the senses, and how often we act quite blindly in quite automatic ways, and then find reasons to justify what we've done after the case, and not also being really honest to ourselves about that's what's happening. A favorite experiment of mine took place in America a number of years ago, conducted by Professor Charles Tart, some of you may have heard of. He was very interested in hypnosis. So he hypnotizes some of his students. This particular case, he says to the student, when you come out of the hypnotic state, whenever I invite you to have a cup of tea, I want you to get up and put up that umbrella behind the door. So the young man comes out of the hypnotic state, they're sitting chatting, and then the professor says, would you like a cup of tea? Immediately, the young man gets up, walks over to the door, puts up the umbrella. Professor Tart says, what did you do that for? He said, well, when I came, I noticed that it was rather windy and blowy, and I'm afraid on the way home it's going to rain, and I was just, not that umbrella looks rather old and tattered, and I wonder whether it was actually usable, and I might bother ask to use it on the way home. Immediately, without having to think, in a fraction of a second, he had a completely believable, rational set of explanations for an utterly 100% irrational action. That's really indicative of, you know, the way a lot of us live our lives. But it's so normal, we just don't obviously realize what we're doing. So sila and the keeping of precepts, it's not just a precondition for spiritual life. It's part of spiritual life. It is a form of pavana. Now, the word pavana, strictly speaking, would be translated as development or cultivation. But it's this word which has most commonly been translated into English as meditation. And so this very reductionist idea of what Buddhism is about has taken hold. You know, Buddhism, you meditate, you sit with your eyes closed, and or maybe you walk up and down. But actually what the Buddha was talking about was pavana and development. So he's talking about, as I say, development of your relationship to the physical world in which you live, the world of objects, and development of your relationship with the people around you, the world you live in. And these are every much as authentic elements of the spiritual training in Buddhism as meditation, concentration, development of insight and vipassana and whatever. You know, it's an organic whole, and it's not possible to pursue one part of this practice in isolation from the others if it wants to really attain any kind of success in the practice. So we take on precepts as a way of guarding ourselves from committing acts of verbal, physical karma, which are going to have unpleasant results for ourselves and others in future. And there are two other qualities of mind which help us to keep precepts, apart from this contemplation and reflection on their value and the drawbacks of not keeping them. And these are two qualities which again are often not very well understood. And these are qualities that we usually translated as shame and fear. So these are not immediately attractive spiritual goals, I think, for most people. You know, I don't want to become a Buddhist so I can have more shame and fear. But the meaning of these terms is perhaps surprising. The Buddha encouraged us to reflect on who we are on the conventional level. Say, before we get on to more refined analysis of the nature of body and mind, say, we are on a day-to-day level human beings. We are householders, mothers, fathers, children, brothers, sisters, employers, employees, and so on and so forth. And the Buddha encouraged us to reflect on, given this conventional identity we have, you know, what is our idea of the right, the best, the most correct way of fulfilling that responsibility of living in that identity? So if you're a father, you know, what do you think it means to be a good father? If you're a mother, what does it mean to be a good mother? If you're a brother, a sister, a friend, you know, what does that mean? And what are your goals? What are your ideals? You're a Buddhist, a lay Buddhist. What does that mean? What is the standard that you aspire to? Now, through reflecting in this way wisely, you develop what we call a sanya, or a particular perception, which you hold wisely and bear in mind. Now, what happens is if you consider acting in a way which conflicts with that, then directly following the cognition that, you know, this doesn't fit, there is an emotion arises, and that emotion is what we call in Buddhism hiri, or shame. So shame is the emotional counterpart to the cognition that we're considering acting and speaking, conducting ourselves in a way which conflicts with our goals, aspirations, and ideals. So if you can consciously reflect and consider those goals and those aspirations regularly, then the more likely it is that, that sense of wholesome, intelligent shame will arise. And in the Buddhist scriptures, it says that shame is the result of self-respect. Now, the other factor of fear, this refers to reflection on the law of karma and the observation of the effects of the way that we think and act and speak have on our lives and other people's lives, observing the same truth in the lives of those around us. So we have a more and more refined ability to reflect on the consequences of our actions. Now, if we are able to do that, and at the moment that we're or preceding the action itself, we recognize that the consequences of this action, short-term, long-term, the ramifications, the effects on other people, are going to cause suffering, difficulty. We want to do it. We think it's going to be good fun. We really like to do it, but something that says, you know, there will be this and this and the consequences. If that's followed through, an emotion arises in the mind, and that emotion is what we call otapa, or fear. So it's not, these are not irrational, unwholesome kind of emotions. These are a particular kind of shame and a particular kind of fear. We call them intelligent shame, intelligent fear. But these two qualities strengthen the ability to live within the boundaries of the precepts. Now, the Buddha says when you live within the boundaries of the precepts, where you set yourself certain standards and you are committed to them and you can live within them, this is the most effective way of creating basic sense of self-esteem. creating boundaries for yourself, which you take on voluntarily and because you see the value of them, and then having the confidence that you know that whatever might be the enticements or the encouragement to transgress those boundaries, you can live within those boundaries. This gives rise to self-confidence and self-esteem, which gives the basic sense of well-being which you need to develop the internal education or training. So there's a lot of talk in Buddhism about suffering, but the fact that's often overlooked or not mentioned is that only a happy mind can understand suffering. If you're suffering, there's no way that you can understand suffering. You don't have the distance from it, and you still assume it's me and my suffering. So the first noble truth of suffering is there's no I am suffering. The first noble truth is there is suffering. And that initial insight can only come through where the mind is stable and calm pervaded by a basic sense of well-being. And that basic sense of well-being means living a balanced, simple life, and one in which we have that basic sense of confidence and lack of guilt from inability to govern one's actions and speech within the most skillful parameters that one aspires to. But of course you can make a decision, as I said, to refrain from acting upon negative emotions, but you can't make a decision not to have negative emotions. If you do try to forbid yourself from having a negative emotion, then you're going to get pretty screwed up because you can't do it. You have to recognize the limitations of volition and intention. It only works with action and speech. For the mind, then we have to develop other techniques. And the kind of qualities that we're seeking to develop really all cluster around this quality of mindfulness. But one other factor, and one which the Buddha himself gave primary importance to, is patient endurance, patience. And this is, again, not a quality which is greatly praised these days. Indeed, one measure of civilization these days seems to be, or progress, means that you can find a way of living in a situation in which you don't have to exercise any patience, where everything comes very easily. But the emotional intelligence movement has a number of interesting things to say about this, and the man who wrote the book on emotional intelligence, Daniel Goleman, is actually a Buddhist. He relates this famous cookie experiment where you get kids of 4 years old, and the adult gives them a cookie and says, "I'm going out for a few minutes, I'll come back. If you've still got your cookie, I'll give you a second one, and if you've eaten it, that's all you get." And of course they've got a camera, a hidden camera on the child, and some of the kids, they hide it so they can't see it. Some of them walk up and down, and some of them some of them just can't help themselves, and they eat the cookie. So they recorded all the results of the kids who could and couldn't delay the gratification, eating the cookie at the year 4 years old. And kept track of these kids, and then when they took their SAT tests at the age of 17, they found an incredible correlation between the kids' academic success at 17 and the ability to delay gratification at 4. Not only that, but there was almost zero correlation between IQ scores at 4 and academic success at 17. So the most reliable predictor of academic success, social success, at a young age is not IQ, it's patience. And I think this has very important ramifications for education in particular, and kindergarten education in particular. So patience is a virtue, and it's kind of the poor relation of virtues, isn't it? Because you think, well, I didn't really get anything out of it. I suppose I got a bit of patience anyway, you know, sort of put up with it. But, you know, to make patience something you aspire to, rather than, you know, something, well, it's a kind of consolation prize if everything else goes wrong. That's a kind of a different way of looking at things. But patience was probably the teaching that was most stressed by my teacher, Ajahn Chah. And I think patience was probably the first Thai word I ever learned, because when I was first at Wat Pho Phong and having to sit and listen to long talks that I didn't understand 2-3 hours at a time, you know, and just be certain sounds that you'd hear and ask somebody. I notice when he talks, he's always talking, he's saying otton, otton, otton. You know, what does that mean? And he said, oh, it means patient endurance. You know. So I realized straight away it was a key teaching in the forest tradition. And if you don't have any patience, then you know you may have read a lot of books and know all the highfalutin concepts, but you know you don't get that far if you give up when things get tough, and if you can't put up with a little bit of discomfort, then you know you're never going to get very far in any area of life, really. But it's particularly true of spiritual life. But mindfulness is the quality that we do put a lot of effort into, the ability to be present, and to be awake and aware. Again, one of the values of meditating, even in a period when you don't feel you're really getting much out of it, is that you are, at very least, illuminating the way in which your mind usually functions, or perhaps more accurately, malfunctions. Just to see just how difficult it is to be present, even for more than a few seconds at a time, and how much the mind shies away from present difficulties or lack of interest, lack of stimulation, immediately into memory, imagination. How poorly the mind is able to deal with the way things are. I think very good example of this, I always think, is if you're on a plane or any kind of public transport. You say a plane, particularly a long journey, you know, and you have there's movies and there's food and people have books and so on, you know. But the moment that there's no stimulation, you know, through the movie or the book or the food, almost everybody falls asleep, don't they? If there's not something coming in and keeping you awake, you know, there's no kind of inner resource of wakefulness. You know, you just when the external stimulus is gone, there's nothing internally to just go to sleep. And so you know, there is this constant oscillation between kind of frantic activity and dullness in most people's minds. So, you know, you know how to think, and you know how to, you know, to switch off. But to be able to enter into and to dwell in this state where it's not necessary to think. You can think if you want to, but you don't have to think. It's not sort of compulsive activity. But you are at the same time extremely awake and aware and bright. This is the kind of skill that one's learning from mindfulness practice, and it is certainly very difficult to do, but it is a wonderful challenge. And if you apply yourself to it, you very soon realize, you know, there's really nothing else to do. I mean, it just dwarfs in significance, really anything else you can do with your life. That's not, you know, recommending everyone become a monk or a nun, of course, but it means, you know, in whatever path of life you find yourself, when you embark on this this training, then you start to notice and observe and awake to all kinds of things that you shut your eyes to before, contradictions, conflicts within become exposed. You find you can't lie to yourself or fool yourself quite in the way that you did. So it can be quite frightening in a way. And this is why the Buddhist tradition, there is emphasis on giving, sharing, generosity and precepts, because it gives you the courage to be able to go within and to look very closely at things that you'd never looked at before. So this quality of courage is very important. And again, my teacher Ajahn Chah, he once, talking to all of us all the monks, he said, you know, don't think there's such a huge gap between me and you. He said, if I can point to any one single difference, it says that I dared to do it. I dared to go against my own conditioning, my habits, my desires, my likes and my dislikes. You know, I put my life on the line. You know, I was that committed to it. But don't think that I was born with all these incredible, elevated spiritual qualities and it was easy for me. It was not easy, but I dared to do it. So that that's a real quality in spiritual life that's very much needed. I think it's quite a story of one of the Tibetan teachers who, this was before the Chinese took over Tibet, and was a deputation of senior Tibetan monks. This particular monk was much younger, but he was a Rinpoche. He was recognized from a young age as a great master, being reborn. And so he's given a lot of respect, even though he was still very young. So the deputation of monks walked into this monastery, and suddenly this really big, nasty, ferocious dog came out from behind a building, teeth bared, and coming towards them. And everybody froze. And then the young Rinpoche ran. Yeah. But instead of running away from the dog, he ran right towards the dog at top speed. And then the dog just completely stunned and, oh, and then ran away. And afterwards he said, yeah, that's how you deal with obstacles. You know, you may think that running away is the best policy, but actually running towards it is perhaps more wise. So we have this teaching in Buddhism of looking at suffering. Buddha said famously, all my teachings, 45 years, can be summarized in just two things: suffering and the end of suffering. And this is considered what Buddhism is all about. Now, those two points are expanded into four. So the first one is suffering and the cause of suffering. And the third, the end of suffering, is supplemented by the path to the end of suffering. It gives us the Four Noble Truths. Now, the Buddha said that there are particular he called duties, responsibilities, correct practices towards each of these four factors. So he said, the first noble truth of suffering is something to be comprehended. And second, the cause of suffering is to be abandoned. The cessation of suffering is to be realized, and the path to cessation of suffering is to be developed. So the second of those 4 points, tanha or craving, again a quality which has been poorly rendered, poorly translated, and given rise to a lot of misunderstandings. Buddhism doesn't say that suffering arises from desire. Buddhism says that suffering arises through tanha, which is a particular kind of desire. So there is a distinction between wise and unwise desire. Unwise desire is called tanha, and this is the cause of suffering. It's unwise because it arises from a lack of understanding or a wrong understanding of the way things are. A correct understanding of the way things are leads not to indifference or passivity. On the contrary, it leads to wise desire, which is called dhammacanda. And this dhammacanda, this wise desire, is one of the most significant engines for spiritual development, that you really do need to have that forceful, committed kind of desire for practice. So how are they different? Well, tanha, coming from ignorance, is characterized by its desire for results, and particularly in the realm of feelings. Generally, it's a desire for some kind of feeling. Whereas chanda, dhamma chanda, is a desire for the action itself rather than the result. So if you want to do a good action, that's not craving, that's chanda. But if you want to be a good person, or you want praise, or you want some kind of reward for that, then that would be tanha. So one can merge into the other quite easily. But there is a definite difference. So if you're working and you see work as merely the means by which you will get what you really want, which is money or status, then you're guided by tanha, craving. But if your main interest is in the work itself, doing a good job, the joy of doing something well, and the monetary reward or other kind of social rewards are secondary to that, then you're primarily guided by chanda. So Buddhism is not at all teaching the abandonment of all forms of desire, but it's teaching the abandonment of the unwise kinds of desire. This has implications in many areas. For instance, the extent to which, say, in modern business world, you have like performance-based pay. This idea that giving people more pay for more measurable results is necessarily a good thing. And there's a very interesting experiments where they've given children, two groups of children, puzzles to do. And one group of children is given some kind of reward for success in working out these puzzles. The other kids are not. So after they've been working on these puzzles for a certain amount of time, then the experimenters say, okay, time's up, but if you want to carry on, do so. And they find that the kids who have not been given any reward carry on with the puzzles, whereas the kids that have been given a reward just stop because, well, you know, they've got their reward. But the other kids actually have got into it now, and they've got the chanda, and they're into doing this, working these things out because they want to, because they enjoy it, because it's a challenge. And this is, you know, the whole question of reward and motivation is an interesting one. I read about a kindergarten school in Israel, and they had a problem that the parents... some parents were coming to pick up their kids late, and it was so the teachers had to hang around, and it was so they decided the way to solve this problem was to fine the parents who came late. And after this system was introduced, the number of parents coming late increased, and the explanation being now they felt, well, it was all right to come late as long as you paid for it. So yeah, the whole question of reward and motivation is an area that you know, really is something to go into, and something that you can see in meditation. So if in meditation practice, you know, if you tanha, you know, some people meditate because they'd like to have visions, or they like to get psychic powers, or they like to be somebody special. I like to have some kind of special experience. You know, you think, well, if I have a special experience, therefore I'm special. Whereas the correct way is to understand that meditation is not about having special experiences, but it's about fully understanding ordinary experience. Because all experience is still within the realm of samsara. It's not that you want to get rid of some experiences and get some other experiences and become someone who has special experiences, but you want to understand the nature of experience, because all experience is addictive. And the clear understanding of the nature of experience is the way to freedom. So one has to be constantly monitoring one's intention in practice. And if you can give rise to this chanda, then it means that your meditation practice is not going to be affected by success or failure. You know, if you think meditation goes well, you have a few peaceful sessions and you get really inspired, and then you want to be meditating every day, and then things go wrong and it's not like it used to be, and then you don't want to do it anymore. So my teacher would say the most important idea is, you say, if I feel diligent and inspired, I'll do it. When I feel lazy and uninspired, then I'll do it. So it's not, you know, the worldly way is, when I feel inspired, I'll do it, and when I feel uninspired, I won't. Because then you're just still following the kind of the worldly stream. So the practice of mindfulness, learning to be in the present moment, again, please recognize that being in the present moment is not a good in itself. You know, there's lots of ways of being in the present moment which are not particularly wholesome and not particularly useful. You can take some drugs and you can be quite in the present moment, not thinking about the past or the future. But the presence of mind that the Buddha's talking about is not one which precludes necessarily thoughts of the past and future. It's merely that a thought of the past is recognized as such, and a thought of the future is recognized as such. So in any kind of activity, you need to be bearing in mind certain information, certain experiences in the past, which will help you to perform your particular duty well in the present, even in meditation, where you're not really thinking. You have a pool of experiences from the past, of ways of dealing with particular problems and challenges that arise. You have a memory of words and teachings that you've received from your teacher or you've read. And staying in the present moment doesn't mean that you have to censor all of that. Of course, you make use of it. Similarly, there is scope for making plans for the future. The Buddha himself spoke about the future, saying in the future if monks act in such a way, then Buddhism will last for a long time. If monks act in another such way, then it will disappear very quickly. And so the Buddha didn't reject past and future matters, but is recognizing them as such. The idea is to be present in such a way that wisdom and understanding arises. So when the mind is mindful, there is this ability to be present to whatever comes up and to see it as such. It's a feeling, to see a feeling as a feeling, to see to be aware of perception as perception, thought as thought, imagination as imagination, without instinctively pushing away those things that make us feel uncomfortable, or grasping on and holding on to those things that make us feel comfortable and make us feel good. And developing this equanimity of mind and balance of mind, which is looking and learning from experience, and both experience conventionally considered as unpleasant and as pleasant. So in meditation, for instance, we have wonderful opportunity to look at physical pain under a microscope, through a microscope. So pain is conditioned, our ability to endure pain and the intensity of pain is conditioned by all kinds of factors. One is the sense that does the pain have meaning or not? What does this pain mean? That this is a major factor in determining intensity of painful feelings. So if you're meditating and you're voluntarily meditating, then and willing to look at pain, then it has a meaning for you, and you begin to see the extent to which the mind adds on to physical sensations with fear, anxiety, aversion, and so on and so forth. And as mindfulness becomes stronger, you're able to separate the physical sensation itself from the mental reaction to it. So this is one of the values of developing this ability to be present, so that when the unpleasant physical sensation arises, not just trying to get away from it, there is that patience, ability to endure, and that mindfulness and alertness. And you begin to notice all kinds of things that you never noticed before. For instance, that common sense, we say, before you can think, there's got to be a thinker, or before you can feel, there's got to be one who feels. But when you're in the realm of direct experience, you start to notice that the thought comes first and the thinker comes afterwards, and the feeling comes first and the feeler comes afterwards. Merely by developing this ability to look at things, you begin to see all kinds of aspects of experience that you'd never observed before, and your understanding of yourself begins to change. And when you begin to see negative emotions, how they arise, how they capture the mind, how they disappear, then there's much more willingness to forgive yourself and also to forgive other people. When you understand the way the mind works, you understand and you can feel more empathy for the way that other people's minds work. So although this can be sometimes represented as a very kind of introspective or individual kind of practice, the fact that we live with other people means that it's never that way, that any kind of benefits that one attains through increase in mindfulness and peace and so on is inevitably felt by those around us. But also the more insight that we have into the way our own body and mind works means the more insight we have into the human condition, and the more understanding, forgiveness, compassion for others that we should feel. Indeed, if we're meditating for any period of time and we don't observe an increase of kindness and compassion for others and a commitment to reducing human suffering wherever we can, then that's a sign that the meditation is not really being pursued in the correct way. In other words, the measure of wisdom is compassion, and the measure of authentic compassion is wisdom. These things go together. So the more that we're able to calm the mind and to abandon and to let go of the thoughts, the perceptions, the proliferations that agitate and cloud the mind, the more clear and bright the mind is in the present, the more we are able to see the nature of things, free of our habitual prejudices and concepts, and the more we can start to align ourselves with the nature of things rather than how we things are, how we like things to be, or how we're afraid things are. So the calming of the mind, the abandonment of the negative emotions, and the development of positive emotions, which forms the third area of education, leads on to this fourth area of wisdom and insight. So as I understand it, and this Buddhist training is not, you know, as a matter of meditating every day or something. It's a whole new attitude to your whole life. Both external and internal, an interest in studying, learning, and inclining the mind towards peace and understanding in every moment of the day. So I think I've spoken for long enough. You've been very patiently sitting there, and perhaps we could have a break for a few minutes now, if you'd like to stretch your legs, or if anybody like to use the toilet, and then come back again. If anybody would like to ask any questions or discuss anything, then please feel free to do so.